My name is Gary Coles. The title of this conference is Christian Nonviolence, Is a Heresy or Is It the Peace Plan of God? The Untried Peace Plan of God. And let me just read the dictionary definition of heresy. Heresy is an opinion or doctrine at variance with the orthodox or accepted doctrine, especially of a church or religious system. And heretic is a professed believer who maintains religious opinions contrary to those accepted by his or her church or rejects doctrines prescribed by that church. So, I think I can persuade you by the end of this talk that the answer is both. And shall we begin? Come on in. Are there any leftover handouts? If not, at the end of the hour, there are some handouts I can get to you folks. For the latecomers, the title of the talk is Christian Nonviolence, Is It Heresy or Is It the Forgotten Peace Plan of God? And I just read the dictionary definition of heresy, and I think at the end of the hour we'll have to conclude that it's both heresy and the peace plan of God. Christian nonviolence is the forgotten core of the Christian gospel. Christian scholars, whether from the conservative or the progressive angle, agree that Jesus was a pacifist. Those who were at the conference last night heard that documentation. Jesus is a pacifist. There's no question about that. The apostles were pacifists. They were willing to die, but never to kill. And the early Christian church, for virtually all of the first 300 years of Christianity, regarded itself as a pacifist community. They were conscious objectors to war. They refused to join war, Rome's military, despite persecutions. A number of reasons. For one thing, they knew that the temple of God on earth was the human person, the site of the Holy Spirit, the spark of the divine, and that injuring a temple, damaging a temple, was desecration of the temple. They understood that. They refused to kill. Jesus was explicit in all of his teachings that killing was outside the mind of Christ. In addition, joining the Roman military would have required idol worship because any soldier had to pledge allegiance to Caesar, and that was idolatry. So there's no doubt I can spend 2 or 3 hours documenting additional information if anybody wants me to go on and on, but scholars agree that the early Christian church was a nonviolent community and taught and lived the central teaching of Jesus, that that of nonviolent love of friend and enemies. Love of enemies was not a throwaway line. New Testament scholars don't agree on very many things as being the authentic words of Christ, but love your enemies is right up there at the top. They all agree that those were the actual words of Jesus. This, of course, caused them to suffer. I mean, when you love your enemies, that's a difficult thing to do, and that's one reason many, many people have rejected Christianity. They prefer, you know, a gentle Buddha to a Jesus that required the disciples to actually love one's enemies. But it actually was practical for the early Christians, despite some persecution, a lot of persecution at various times, depending on their the emperor that was in control at the time. It was the persecutions were at times benign and at times severe. But it was practical because despite the persecutions, they grew and flourished until they were the largest religion in the empire at the time of Constantine, around 300. So it worked for them, and what people saw outside the Christian community, they saw the love for one another, love for God, one for one's neighbors, love for one's enemies. And people wanted that. It was a brutal time in Palestine. Roman occupation, brutal colonization. There were crucifixions all over the place. One scholar estimated that Jesus had probably seen 2,000 crucifixions in his lifetime. I don't know where he got that figure. But crucifixions were extremely common method of terrorizing the citizenry into obedience. So that that most brutal of tortures, crucifixion, was a commonplace event. So the concept of love of enemies, again, that could be a 2 or 3 hour session, and I did it earlier this week. There's no question Jesus said it. There's no question he practiced it. Everywhere in the New Testament where it is stated, love your enemies, is in the command imperative. That means there's no options. It's a command. And it's also always in the plural, not just enemy, but enemies, all inclusive. At this point, it's probably important to explain briefly what love means in the New Testament, because there's tremendous confusion, because our word for love is equivalent to eros, and there's three different words for love in Greek in the New Testament. You know, and our, and I should back up, the three words for love in Greek are eros, which is our common everyday word for love, and the Greeks and the Palestinians' everyday word for love. And it includes erotic love or romantic love or love for a hamburger, or, you know, love for your wife. That's what eros means. Then there's philia, that's brotherly or sisterly love, Philadelphia. And then there's agape. And agape is Christian love, the love that is modeled by Christ, and it means at least two things. And these are the core definitions of agape, or agape, I prefer agape. It's the willingness to serve or love without the desire for reciprocation. That means if I'm going to be loving agapeically, I love or serve without requiring anything in return. And the second part of it is it's the willingness to suffer without the desire to retaliate. So in situations where you may be suffering, retaliation is not done. And Jesus lived that. He taught it. He lived it. And the point about love is that in the New Testament, it's about 330 some times that love is used in the New Testament. Agape is used 320 of those times. Philia is used the others, and eros is never employed. So our everyday English word for love is never employed in the New Testament. Can you see the confusion, you know? So when we do the 1 Corinthians 13 at a wedding or something like that, it's not erotic love, you know? It's agape, the love that was modeled by Christ. In John 13, just on the Maundy Thursday, the night before he was going to be crucified, he tells the disciples in the upper room, "I give you a new commandment, love one another as I have loved you." And that's the command to the disciple, which is those who profess Christianity. Tough, you know, that's tough. And of course, we all notice in there the willingness to suffer without the desire to retaliate. That's the tough part. Nobody ever said Christianity was going to be easy, and it certainly wasn't for the early Christians. And you can see why that's such a tough thing. Christian nonviolence is pacifism. And again, I should explain. Christian model for pacifism is not passive, P-A-S-S-I-V-E. Passive means, you know, limp, you're a doormat, you know, you don't resist. That's passive. Pacifism's root word is just peace, P-A-C-I-F, Pacific, peace. So people confuse that a lot too, the difference between being passive and being a pacifist, entirely different, because the model of pacifism from Jesus is active resistance to evil, but nonviolent. And we know how Martin Luther King did it, you know. We knew how Mahatma Gandhi did it. Mahatma Gandhi was a Hindu, and he learned his lessons that overthrew brutal English colonization of India by nonviolent methods. And he learned it from the Sermon on the Mount. So that was what inspired me. And then he read Leo Tolstoy's The Kingdom of God is Within You. So those two things, which are basically about pacifism, Christian pacifism, were the things that inspired Gandhi.
What was the Christian?
The Sermon on the Mount.
Oh.
Right. And of course, Gandhi, Martin Luther King, visited Gandhi or visited Gandhi's the heritage and learned all about Gandhi, and he also understood what Jesus was all about, and that was nonviolence. And it works, people, say, well, I'm nonviolent unless, most of us think we're nonviolent, but we're not. It's not the same nonviolence as Jesus. Jesus rejected violence. Most of us do it on condition. It's sort of we're nonviolent unless someone attacks me, then I'm going to retaliate. That's how most of us are. That's human nature. Our parents or my dad, I don't know if my dad did it, but most people's dads, we come home from school and say, somebody hit me. He said, well, did you hit him back? That's not Christic love. That's not the nonviolence of Jesus. But we don't learn it in Sunday school. At least I didn't. And the churches in my community don't teach that. But, our pastors, by and large, don't learn it either. I've discovered that Christian nonviolence, which is the most ancient Christian spiritual tradition, love your enemies, all the nonviolence that Jesus taught, is not taught in the seminaries. There's a theological consortium in Boston. The best theological education you can find in the world is 8 or 10 seminaries in the Boston area. They offer thousands of courses every year, and in the last 10 years, there has not been one course taught on the history, theology, or spirituality of Christian nonviolence. Not one. Yeah.
Not in
the Boston Consortium. And the Mennonites and the Quakers and the Brethren, the Classical Peace churches, those, I'm talking about mainstream seminaries. My seminary in Minnesota is Luther, and there's no courses on Christian nonviolence there. In fact, as I am a Lutheran Peace Fellowship board member, and my pet project is to get the seminaries to start teaching the course, or how are those of us in the pews going to learn it, and how are the kids going to learn what is the peace plan of God? That's the second part of this. I didn't write the title of the talk, but is Christian nonviolence heresy, or is it the forgotten peace plan of God? It's both. In Lutheran, at least in Lutheran tradition, we sort of abide by the 16th article of the Augsburg Confession, which says that the Lutheran may fight in just wars, be a soldier, and among other things, administer punishment through the courts, and that includes capital punishment, although that's implied, and we go along with capital punishment because it says that in the Augsburg Confession. Philip Melanchthon wrote the Augsburg Confession. Luther didn't, and when Luther read it, he said, that's pretty soft. That would have been a lot tougher. So I don't know what Luther would have said. He might have had it a little more spice. I don't know, as Lutherans, if we have to abide by all the articles of the Augsburg Confession. I certainly, when I was confirmed, I certainly didn't read it and sign my name, so maybe it's not an inviolable rule. I suspect it isn't, but it is considered dogma by many people, I suspect. And then, of course, most mainline churches in the world today abide by the just war theory. And they don't teach that in seminary either to any degree. I don't know if anybody here had a course or at least a substantial lecture on the just war theory. I talk to people and I understand by other people who have studied the issue that isn't taught, or if it is, it's not with any emphasis. And the just war theory, that would take another hour to actually discuss that. But one of the inviolable rules in the just war theory is that civilians are not involved in war. Civilians are not threatened in war. So in modern warfare, where there's total war and weapons of mass destruction used regularly, there's no such thing as a just war. Most Americans think that World War II was a just war because, we were fighting a tyrant. I mean, Hitler was horrible, and so were the Japanese army. I mean, I'm talking about the armies on each side, the military on each side committed atrocities. So I'm not defending that. But of the 52, and some say 54 million people that died in World War II, 48% were civilians. Non-combatants are to be protected in just wars, and we gleefully join, and the church is silent on the issue. The early church, again, they were conscientious objectors to war. In my church and the churches I know in Minnesota, nobody mentions the possibility that our sons and daughters can be conscientious objectors to war. I was chairman of our social justice committee for a couple years, was very active, and I didn't have the courage to raise that issue. I figured,
church?
In my church, yeah. I was going to do it, and my wife says, wait a minute, you better think about that. You know, we're already kind of on the outs because we're outspoken on issues of peace and nonviolence. That's not a very popular topic. And I sort of felt like a heretic. And when I looked up the definition of heresy, I said, I'm a heretic. So peacemakers, pacifists, according to the dictionary definition of heresy, qualify, at least in our church, as heretics. I mean, I don't think I'm going to be subjected to a heresy trial, but anybody listening, I'm guilty. I'll stand trial if someone wants to make the charge. I shouldn't be facetious here, but there are times pacifists are treated brutally. I mean, in the history, if you read the history of Christian pacifism or even non-Christian pacifism, there's a lot of brutality. The Hutterite community, I read the story of the four Hutterites that, of course, their Christianity, their sect are pacifists. They refuse to join the military, and it's because of their religious beliefs, and it's based on the life of Jesus. It's absolutely clear that Christians have the right to do that, but they were brutally treated. They were taken off as in the wintertime. They were forced to stand naked in freezing weather. They were taken to Alcatraz. They were beaten and tortured, and two of them died. This was in World War I. Now, there hasn't been a torture or any capital punishment of since then in America, but there certainly are instances where pacifists who refused to join were treated rather cruelly. In fact, my organization, Lutheran Peace Fellowship, originated out of a group of Lutheran pastors who objected to World War II, refused to be drafted, and they were taken off into it wasn't really a concentration camp, but they were taken off away from their families into an area where they were forced to do alternative service, just sort of, I think, in the woods somewhere. But they were also forced to pay for their own lodging and their own food, and they couldn't afford it. The government, was sort of trying to make an issue out of it. And so a bunch of other Lutherans got together to raise money to support this group of Lutheran pastors who were peacemakers. And out of that grew Lutheran Peace Fellowship, which is not a pacifist organization. Some of us are pacifists, but all of them are peacemakers, which, of course, Christians, by definition, should be peacemakers, I would think. That's a pretty clear, statement in the Bible. Jesus was the Prince of Peace. Blessed are the peacemakers. If you read the Bible from this standpoint of Christian nonviolence, it's virtually uncountable the ways you can interpret and read phrases and statements of Jesus and actions in Jesus that represent nonviolent love of friend and enemies. As just brief examples, when Jesus was in the garden, he knew he was going to be arrested, knew what was coming, and the armed servant of the high priest comes in, Peter cuts off the ear, Jesus could have escaped, there was confusion, he could have gotten away, but he knew he had the power to love, and he knew that he was that was most important. He knew he had the power to heal, and he reached over and healed the ear of the one who was going to take him to his death. He loved his enemy without condition, the one that was going to take him to his death. That's love of enemies. On the cross, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Love of enemies. He lived it. And that's the power of love. The power of violence is the power of the predictable or the possible. When we use violence, we can kind of predict what's going to happen. You stab somebody in the heart, they're going to die. Explode something over Nagasaki, you can sort of estimate how, you can predict how many people are going to be dead or what the temperature is in the core of the bomb, et cetera, how long it's going to take to kill lots of people. The power of agape love is the power of the impossible. It's the power of the resurrection is love, the power to empty tombs. That's the power of agape love. And Jesus demonstrated that for us. I want to just do a little brief thing on Christian ethics, which is kind of important that to make love of enemies make sense. If we have any umbrella. Well camouflaged. In all rational ethical systems, the main operating principle, the first operating principle is survival. That's whether it's personal ethics, personal survival, it's military ethics, it's survival of your military, national ethics, survival of a nation. Anyway, whatever system you want to kind of figure out your morality, the standards, the rules, and things like that, you can make a list, and in there, ethically, you shouldn't kill anybody, and you shouldn't rape, and you shouldn't commit arson, and you shouldn't lie and steal and cheat, and there's a whole list of other items underneath there. Christian ethics, the primary operating value is Christ-like love. Love as I loved you. Love is Christ-like. Christ loves. Nonviolent love of friend and enemies. And then there's a bunch of others. Thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not whatever, everything like underneath. So there's a whole bunch of other ones. But the primary one is Christ-like love. And this is another lecture that should take an hour, but I'm just going to give you this brief thing because it helps us make understand why we can, as Christians, love our enemies. And that's the core element of the peace plan, world peace. What is number one on the list of rational ethics is not even on the list of Christian ethics because our survival is guaranteed. It doesn't have to be on there because it's guaranteed. I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me shall live forever. Our survival is guaranteed. So it's not even on there. So we can then go about, and the reason this is so important is that people say, well, if I'm going to survive to, in the future, not rape and kill and steal, I have to at least survive. And then that puts you in the mindset, in order to survive, I might have to rape and kill and steal. And so everything else goes out the window when your survival is threatened. So when our survival is threatened, communism threatens capitalism, we go fight in Vietnam because we want to have our capitalist system survive. And we did Nazi-style atrocities all over Vietnam for 10 years. The average child in Vietnam, only 50% of them in the 10 years we were there reached the age of 5. They were killed, napalm, the land of the burning children. 2 million people died in Vietnam. Over what? Well, McNamara, it was McNamara's war. 25 years later, he finally fessed up and said it wasn't worth it. We didn't belong there. And, the war group, the pacifists, were saying that 25 years ago. Some of the most spiritual people I know were purged from Lutheran churches because they said, we shouldn't be in Vietnam. And the hierarchy said, if you're going to try to make a fuss over that, you may as well go. And because we teach an ethic of justified violence. That's just war theory. We're nonviolent until our survival is threatened. But knowing that our survival is guaranteed gives us the courage to go unarmed against evil, the principalities and the powers. That may entail suffering. The theology of the cross, which as it came to me in the pews, and I suspect that most lay people don't really study the theology of the cross. I suppose there's many volumes of books about theology of the cross. But what I understand it to be is that Jesus died for our sins. And by grace, we are forgiven, et cetera, et cetera. But what that means is that Jesus died for my sins. I don't have to suffer. Isn't that a great religion? We can do anything we want, and by grace, we will be forgiven, and we'll gain heaven by grace, and don't have to worry about the works and that sort of thing. I think that the theology of the cross, you could develop this into a strong argument for all the Christian violence that has occurred in the name of the theology of the cross. Jesus died for my sins. I don't have to suffer for my sins. I can ask for forgiveness, but don't have to do penance, maybe. I'm sure that, you know, it's, the theologians will say, no, that's wrong, that's wrong, you know. But that's what comes across, I think, to most of us in the pews. And who among us wants to suffer, you know? Especially in modern, affluent, arrogant, I'm a modern, affluent American, you know? Most of us don't want to suffer. We kind of are attracted to religions that say, don't have to really love your enemies, you know? You know, we can kick butt once in a while and make us feel good. And I suspect that most of you haven't been to the my other sessions, so I'll just kind of briefly say where the turning point was. 300 years of nonviolence, resistance to evil, nonviolent response to Roman violence led to the growth of the religion. And the Emperor Constantine saw that, and he said, let's stop persecuting them. They're a large group. They're potentially politically powerful. Let's bring them in. And so he said, come on in, and he issued the Edict of Milan that tolerated Christianity. Christianity was a capital offense in the first 250 years or so. I mean, if you professed Christianity, you could be hanged or beheaded or tortured or imprisoned or crucified. So he stopped the persecutions, and because he won a battle, the Battle of Melvian Bridge, he saw the vision before the war, the battle, and it was a vision of the cross, and it said, in this sign you will conquer, and he won the battle and attained the power of the Roman Empire. And so he thought, wow, and he was an emperor of the sun, S-U-N, but... And he used any way he could to gain power. He wasn't a Christian in his lifetime. At least his actions weren't Christ-like. He was baptized on his deathbed. But he was sort of an ally of the Christian church, and he made it the state religion. Long story, that's another hour lecture, but how Constantine sort of had this influence on the Christian church, and he granted power and prestige in pagan temples. He had his Roman army go out there and take pagan temples away from pagans and give them to the Christians. And so, whereas Christianity was a non-temple religion in the first three centuries, now they had property, and they had wealth, and they had power. And the bishops started dressing up like, you know, the emperor, and we started having the glitter and all this. And when you have wealth and when you have property, how do you defend it? With the gun. There's no coincidence that America is the most wealthy nation in the world, and it also spends the most money on militarism and in the world. We spend more money on militarism than practically the whole world combined. And we're only 5 or 6% of the world's population, but we have massive wealth. And we want to keep the hordes elsewhere, you know, so we go on fight in Vietnam, and we go and fight in Iraq to ensure the supply of cheap oil. Our survival is threatened if we have to pay $6 a gallon for gas. And we don't have much gas and oil in the United States anymore. We need control of that for the survival of our commerce. There's probably more reasons than that, but we all know that war was about oil, you know. And Nicaragua and El Salvador, the atrocities that happen in El Salvador and Guatemala and Nicaragua, I mean, if you know the stories on those, I mean, you just have to cringe. And it was a censored bit of news, of course, during those atrocious war years that we were supporting. Hundreds of thousands of people died, hundreds of thousands of people were refugeed, and all in the name of fighting communism, which was a threat to the survival of capitalism, supposedly, you know. Anyway, so when we don't have to worry about our survival as Christians, we can be bold in going up against the principalities and the powers in the model of Jesus, Gandhi, Martin Luther King, and many, many other nonviolent resistors. I mean, the history books censor the stuff, but if you really got the history of the world from the victim standpoint and from the peacemaker's standpoint, there is innumerable examples where nonviolent resistance has worked with very little bloodshed. Doesn't work perfectly, doesn't work all the time, but it does work. And the Berlin Wall fell because of East German nonviolent resistance. That's a story that isn't out there. Ask Michael Moeller. You know, he was involved in the nonviolent resistance in East Germany, and that resulted in the, that was a huge factor in the Berlin Wall coming down. That didn't get in our papers, you know. We prefer to think that it takes violence to bring peace. I should talk about Gandhi's concept of men. What he says, and this is right out of Jesus too, Jesus said, you reap what you sow. You know, if you want to, if your goal is to have corn, you plant corn, you don't plant wheat, you know. If your goal is peace, you don't do it through warfare. If you do, if you try to get somewhere and you use violence, you're going to reap violence. Because human nature is eye for eye, tooth for tooth, retaliation for damage done. And then when someone retaliates, you know they're an SOB, and then you retaliate back, and it just escalates. I mean, that's the history of the world, escalation. Yugoslavia, the Yugoslavia war right now, it's all about what happened in World War II. They were enemies. Croatians helped the Nazis, and the other Serbs around the resistance, and they still remember that, even though it was another generation. So, retaliation just invites more retaliation. So Gandhi says your ends are your means are your ends in embryo, meaning the way you try to attain a goal is what you're going to get. If you want to be a truthful person, you can't get there by telling lies. You have to get there by telling truth. If your goal is peace, you have to use peaceful means to get there. If you use violence, you're going to get violence, retaliation, etc. Jesus in the garden also said, put up the sword. He who lives by the sword dies by the sword. And it's true. Yeah, it's true. I'm a physician who treats patients with post-traumatic stress disorder. I deal with Vietnam veterans a lot. They lived by the sword. And even the ones that didn't die, you know, 58,000 died in Vietnam. Up to 120,000 have committed suicide since the war ended, because of the horrible mental anguish and the torment they go through mentally coming back, knowing the gruesome atrocities that they saw or perpetuated or perpetrated. I mean, the terrible violence that they witnessed, just you can't get that out of your brain. Horrible events like that cannot be unremembered. When there's adrenaline flowing, that embeds in there, and then you have that intrusive memory for the rest of your life, and you can't. And when it happens in the form of nightmares, you can't sleep. In fact, you don't want to go to sleep because you know you're going to have a nightmare. These guys have insomnia. They either can't sleep, or they don't want to go to sleep, or they wake up with a horrible nightmare, and then they can't sleep after that. And you can't hold a job when you have insomnia, and you can't. Then you can't concentrate the next day. And then sometimes they wake up strangling their wife in bed because they think it's a Viet Cong, or there's horrible stories of that. And so marriages get destroyed. And there's, since violent, when you learn violence and cruelty, that's kind of your nature. You know, and if you've ever been through Marine or seen the movies of Marine training camps, you know, kill, 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 no mercy, and those recruits are brutalized from the minute they get off the bus, and they learn the job of being a paid professional killer. I mean, that's what the military is all about. You're here to kill, and the Marines will tell you that. If you're here to type, don't join the Marines. Marines are here to kill. And so even just that going through basic training, can you imagine what that does to family values? And it's documented. There's far higher incidence in domestic abuse in military families, and it's perfectly understandable. And the patients, the people who come back with post-traumatic stress disorder from war that have been in combat, it's the combat veterans, the ones that see the gruesome death, And they're the ones that have the post-traumatic stress disorder, and they have tremendous incidence of chemical dependency, which makes everything worse. And then they waste their money on that, and then they're impoverished, and they can't hold a job, and they lose their marriages, tremendous incidence of divorce, and then they're on the street oftentimes. 30% of the homeless population are Vietnam veterans, and I'll bet you most of them have PTSD. So anyway, that's dying by the sword. That fits my definition of dying by the sword. You live by the sword, you die by the sword. You perpetrate violence, and you can't get over it, and you're dying, and your soul dies. And these guys that come back with PTSD, They say, how can I believe in a loving God? And ministers get asked that question, and they say, I don't know. And they say, you can't. If you've seen hell at that level and you know that God wasn't there, how can you believe in a loving God? Now, these are, you know, that's variable. I mean, there are some Vietnam veterans that came through without that. I'm not saying that it's 100%, but the incidence is extremely high. The VA did a study, and they found that 480,000 Vietnam veterans have full-blown PTSD. That's not counting the up to 120,000 that have committed suicide. Another 250,000 have partial PTSD. Same torment, but they don't have the full-blown expression. That's dying by the sword. Those guys are miserable. And these are the tripwire vets. You know, the guys are out in the woods. They're the hermits. They can't stand stimulation. You know, they can't stand hearing a helicopter that brings the flashbacks. They hear the helicopter, you know, 20 minutes before you and I hear helicopters. They are tuned into that. That's the symbol of the Vietnam War. They're back in the rice paddies, and they're sweating, and they're having a flashback. They're back in battle. And or they taste fish or they smell fish. I mean, there's all sorts of triggers that bring back the horrible, horrible terror, and these people suffer. There was a Marine colonel who was in Vietnam who killed probably more than one with a bayonet, killed a Viet Cong with a bayonet. I don't know if it was a Vietnamese with a bayonet. And he's tormented now by that sound, the sound of the bayonet going in and out of the belly. And his son was a Marine going into the Iraq War, and he went to his son and said, if you have a choice of killing or being killed, let yourself die. That's coming from a Marine. You can imagine the torment he's going through to say it's better to die than to kill, you know? This is a hidden disease, and I shouldn't go on and on about it, but I want to impress you that when Jesus says he who lives by the sword dies by the sword, doesn't necessarily mean that you get killed. You may die psychically. That psychological trauma is severe. Question, yeah.
I think, you know, the idea of leading a peaceful life is easier. I mean, one can understand how that needs to be done individually or the situation you face, but as a government, how do you, that almost leads to me to think of more of an isolation and approach, not involving ourselves with world affairs. How do you, you know, like when you see conflict and suffering in another country like in Bosnia right now, then what would be the peaceful approach for the government?
Well, prevention for one thing. When you're in a hellhole with boiling oil, you know, your pacifist beliefs aren't going to help anymore. I mean, you got to do this as partly as a prevention. No, not just because we need to be outspoken in defense of the oppressed and the victims. We have to be out there on the streets getting hundreds and thousands and tens of thousands of people to object to anything that's causing oppression. If we see fascism coming, and I could give you an hour lecture on that. Believe me, it's on the way, unless something stops the present agenda. Fascism is, of course, militarism. It's anti-labor. It's racism. It's anti-Semitism. It's a conglomeration of industries controlling the agenda of the government and vice versa, you know. This is all, I'm describing the Nazi, I'm describing America, I'm describing fascism in Germany and Italy as well. It's suppressing, it's an anti-intellectualism sort of thing. It's censorship of the news in favor of the military, you know. Do you see the pattern here? It's suppressing the arts. I could tell you a story about how the Nazis ridiculed artists, and they had this in Munich. They had a display, Detente Arte or something like that. Degenerate art, whatever the German is for degenerative art, and they ridiculed artists who were progressive and expressive and creative and Jewish too. And so they, you know, suppressed art. You know, look what's happened to the National Endowment of the Humanities and the National Endowment of the Arts. I mean, it's just this, you know, and Nazism, fascism, of course, a very conservative ideology. But anyway, we need to go up wherever we think we're seeing victims, and we need to nonviolently. I mean, if we arm ourselves, you know, then we're going to get killed, of course. If Jesus had led an armed revolt, there wouldn't be any such thing as Christianity, would there? You know?
There's a difference between suppressing the NEA, National Endowment for Arts, and having it supported by public funds.
Yeah, we can talk about that later. That would be getting a side issue, but I'm giving you the...
Confused, yeah. Because it's totally different.
Yeah. But there are also agendas that we that are hidden from the headlines. From headline news is different from what the agendas of whoever's controlling stuff is. Yeah, and you're right. Yeah, that's. This pattern, the similarities, and the Germans, you know, the Nazis did that very subtly as well. All this stuff, you know, started out as a subtle thing. I'm not saying we're going to have a totalitarian dictatorship, and it might be a form of friendly fascism that's coming. But there's going to be a lot of suffering people. We see it happening. The poor are going to suffer. Mexicans are going to suffer, blacks are going to suffer, women are going to suffer. There's also, you know, Nazism was, and you keep the women suppressed and in the nursery, in the church, and in the bedroom, having babies for the Führer. That's what Nazism was all about. You have women, and they gave kind of medals for the women who had the most babies, because they were going to be the future soldiers for the 1,000 years reign. Anyway. So we need to have the courage to go up wherever innocent people are going to be oppressed. That's what Matthew 25 is all about. You know, that's Matthew 25, 31 to 46. Read that one again and again. That's the one that says, I was hungry and you gave me to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me to drink. And you will be blessed by entering the kingdom of heaven. And the ones that aren't going to enter the kingdom of heaven did not feed the least of these when they were hungry. They did not give drink. They did not visit the prisoner. Anyway, if we have not had mercy to the least of these, that's the standard of judgment at the end of time, according to Matthew 25. Matthew 25 isn't very much discussed from pulpits, but it's there. It's glaring. It says indifference to human suffering is radical evil. Anyway, read that and think about it a little bit. Mercy is Christ-like love. Compassion is Christ-like love. The healing, the feeding. Jesus says, you give them something to eat. That's where it's to be merciful. So anyway, here we are, Christian nonviolence. Yeah, and I think Jesus wept over Jerusalem. He said, you say peace, peace, but you don't know what makes for peace. If only you knew what makes for peace. He told us in the Sermon on the Mount, love your enemies, do good to those who persecute you, pray for those who abuse you, etc., 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 agapeistically. And that would create peace. You're right. It's hard to visualize. How would that work on a national level? But Christians are called to be faithful. You know, we leave the big picture up to God. Mother Teresa said it best. My job is fidelity. God's job is success. We are called to be faithful. We're called to be nonviolent. And we are called not just to be, we aren't called to be passive. We are called to be active and resistant.
You're advocating a withdrawal from
no.
Politics.
No.
Because there's a section of the Christian in which in the past is said we proclaim the gospel. Mm-hmm. We say, you know, we preach God loves us, but we don't get involved in politics. Mm-hmm. You're not...
No. Yeah. You know, people say Jesus wasn't political, but, you know, what's more political than going right into the temple, the center of the, of course, it was religious power center, and then doing the cleansing of the temples, which, by the way, was not an example of violence. If you read the Greek, the Koine Greek of those four descriptions of the cleansing of the temple, and I bring this up because everybody says, well, Jesus was violent. He cleansed the temple. Well, we only get that idea from the Renaissance painters who paint these pictures of a muscular Jesus with a whip and all these cowering people all around. The Renaissance painter loved to paint that scene. But if you look at the Koine Greek, the first three, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, there's not even mention of a whip. It was just kind of overturning the money changers' tables. In John, it says there's a whip of cord. And all he did was move the animals along with it. He did not strike a human. And moving the animals along with a cord is how people move, with a whip is how people move animals along. It's not violence. In fact, he was saving them from being sacrificed. So in a way, you can say he was being merciful to the sacrificial animals.
But he just lost his patience.
Yeah, it was righteous anger, you know. That wasn't violence against humans. I think, and the early church didn't understand it as violence. The early church was pacifist. They didn't understand any of those things in the New Testament that people say, you know, well, Jesus maybe was violent. What about the passage where he says, I come not to bring peace but a sword? That was a metaphor for divisiveness. A sword is a metaphor for divisiveness. If you're going to follow me, you're going to be in trouble. Question?
Yeah. Earlier you were sort of suggesting, it sounded to me, that pacifism can be effective and some people will die, but not necessarily that many. But I think, I mean, 6 million, you know, people, Jews, died in World War II, and I mean, that's a lot to me. And so, I mean, it seems plausible to me that if some military dictatorship were to come to power or something, lots and lots of people could die if they're pacifists. And I'm not suggesting that they should not be for that reason, but I'm saying that it's not clear to me that it will result in not that.
Okay, let's talk about the Nazi regime. Jews weren't Christians, and their tradition isn't pacifist. What didn't happen was that the German churches did not stand up for the oppressed. The German churches were silent in that whole persecution of the Jews because they weren't prepared. They were not peace churches. They were just war churches, just like we are today. I maintain that the German Christian churches are about at the same level as we are as far as our lack of preparedness for going up against a great evil. I don't think we can criticize the German churches because I think our resistance, we're not prepared to resist great evil. It could happen here, and I think we would be saying, well, you have to go to war for the fear, or it's your Christian duty to go to war for the president, I meant. I intended that little slip of the tongue. They were just poor Christians then. They're in it for personal salvation more than defense of the poor and feeding the hungry and, all those things that are all over the gospel. And because they weren't a peace church, Hitler could come to power and wield that power. And the other thing, another blame for the church is that it was Christians who determined the Treaty of Versailles at the end of World War I. And we had tremendous retribution against the German population at the end of World War I. It was oppressive. If you read the articles, and we required tremendous war reparations. And what resulted was tremendous suffering in Germany. There was 50% unemployment. There were food lines. There was starvation and hunger, unemployment, and then massive hyperinflation. They suffered. And in situations like that, demagogues rise to power. Hitler would not have risen to power if the Christians who imposed the terms of the Treaty of Versailles on them had been merciful, had exhibited Christ-like love, been willing to help the German people instead of get the vengeance. They believed eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, and worse, which Jesus specifically repudiated, You've heard it said of old, an eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth, but I say to you, love your enemies.
Eric, you need to make a distinction between pacifism and active nonviolence.
Okay, yeah. There are at least a couple of forms of pacifism, and one is that courageous going up against the violent people or violent principalities and the powers. Yeah, that's active nonviolence. And then there's non-resistant. I think one of the interpretations in one of the New Testament passages, it says, resist not evil. And of course, I like Walter Wink's exegesis of that passage, resist not evil. He says Jesus' model was not non-resistance, but active resistance. So that's active nonviolence is active resistance, but you do so without exhibiting any threats to homicide or violence. Did you have something to expand on that?
I think the image of pacifism is to just lie down.
Yeah.
And do nothing.
That's right. That's not.
And when you follow people like Dan Berrigan, you know that that's not true. Mm-hmm. That's not his way. Martin Luther King's way. They were not pacifists. Mm-hmm. They faced the evil and do something about it by acting out
right.
In a nonviolent way.
Right.
make it well known, expose the powers and principles of powers, yeah. And William Stringfellow does a lot of that.
Yeah. And when Jesus says, turn the other cheek, everybody says, well, that's passivity, isn't it? Walter Wink has a great thing on that. He says, and he actually says, when you are struck, turn your right cheek. And what people in position of authority would do, they would hit backhanded. A right-handed authoritarian person would strike the right cheek of the other person. And what the Christian is to do is to turn the left cheek. Just say, okay, I'm not going to hit you back. Hit me again, which was a very embarrassing thing to the person in authority, you know, because he just did something brutal, and now he's being challenged to hit the other cheek. And so it was that's sort of an act of nonviolence. He's resisting it, but not by striking back. But he says, you dare hit me again, you know, and then that embarrasses the person, and then that stops the violence cycle.
There's something in the culture back there, the difference between the slapping with the open hand, slapping with the
hand. I think so, and Wink explains that, I think, yeah.
There was also something where it was two strikes, and then he struck back.
Was there?
Yeah. You were given two slaps, and uh-huh. If he slapped you a third time.
Is that right? Okay. Then the other thing about if someone asks for your coat, give them your cloak also, or vice versa. And nobody ever had more than two garments. So if they demanded to take your coat, then you take off your other one too, and you were naked, which would embarrass the other person. And so that's another way of act of nonviolence, you know. Yeah. Well, there's a lot of nakedness in Palestine, a lot of poverty. And then, you know, someone asks you to go the first mile, go the second mile also. I mean, Roman soldiers had the power to make somebody carry their heavy packs for a mile, but they were only limited to 1 mile. So another sign of an act of resistance was, I'm going to carry one more mile, and that would embarrass them.
What kind of pacifism did the country of France demonstrate in the Second World War? France had a very strong army, plus they had a very powerful air force that was on the ground, and it was a larger air force than the German Luftwaffe. Now, what happened to France? Why were they blocked all over?
Yeah, they were, as a nation, none. But they just sort of gave up. They were fully armed, but they just gave up and ran. Yeah, that's right. So that wasn't pacifism. No, not at all. I mean, armies aren't pacifists. Nations, no nations are pacifists. But in you probably know the story of the Le Chambon community. It was a French community that saved thousands of Jews, and they did it at the risk of their own lives. I mean, they were actually having encounters with the Nazis, and they had Jews hidden, but they didn't try to fight them off. They did it nonviolently. They actually did good things to the Nazis, so the Nazis favored that community, and they saved thousands of Jewish lives. The priest that did that was a member of Fellowship of Reconciliation, which is a wonderful reconciliation of peacemakers. Question?
Isn't it inappropriate that the weapons of our warfare are not carnal? We don't use worldly methods or motivations as Christians. That the motivation is totally different and the method is different. And one example to me is pro-lifers who shoot doctors. That is a wrong method, and it's automatically wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to be pro-life and to kill somebody is wrong.
That's right. That's pro-death.
So the motivation is toward peace, reconciliation, unity, pro-life in every sense, psychologically and otherwise. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that goes on to talk about spiritual warfare, that our enemy is not necessarily that person holding the gun at my head, but it's the power of evil that is working against the power of good or the power of God in us.
Mm-hmm.
And one of our main weapons is prayer and spiritual warfare. Mm-hmm. And most Christians are not really educated in spiritual warfare.
That's right.
So we strike back with
precisely
words, arguments, or fists, or in the method of the methods and the weapons of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And automatically in doing so, we are not being Christ.
That's very true. Yeah, you got it right on. And it's important to understand. I'm sure we're all kind of wondering, how am I going to do this in day-to-day life? Well, what we don't do in the little situations, we will not be able to do in the crisis situations. We have to practice this on a day-to-day basis. We have to wake up every morning and say, well, how can I be Christ-like today? Instead of thinking, it's a jungle out there, how am I going to protect number one? We should go out there and be practicing the little act of Christ-like love of friend and enemies unconditionally, you know, whether it's a smile or a good deed or, you know, and especially do it to your enemies. You know, they're a perceived enemy. You may find out that he's not an enemy for long. In fact, what's the best way to destroy an enemy but by turning him into a friend? And that's by doing the Christ-like deed of love. Giving the opportunity. I mean, if you hit back right away, then he knows you, an SOB, and then you better watch your backside. Yeah, that's the escalation thing.
Well, he's coming with his sword out.
Sure.
You may not have an opportunity.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, you might come with a gun, and then you're a goner immediately.
One other aspect of this, too, is as citizens of a democratic country, we can insist that our government pay more attention to more peaceful methods of teaching how to reconciliation between people, you know. Put so much money into guns and stuff and I think that it is, they're doing it a little bit more. There are actually studies in how to negotiate, how to get people to decide.
Right. Bankers are doing a lot
before you're
in
the war.
That's really important, yeah.
So one thing we as Christian citizens can do is to say that this is something that we would like to say, that so many of us in the church weren't anything political. But any kind of love is really aggressive or active. It's proactive.
That's right. You know, everybody else's ethical system at the best is don't return evil for evil. But that isn't Jesus' teachings. It isn't running away from evil or just not retaliating. It's doing good, exchanging good for evil. You know, if evil is done to you, you do good in return. Even Paul got it right. You know, he said in Romans 12, I think, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If your enemy is thirsty, give him to drink. You will heap burning coals on his head, which means that's going to make him sweat. I mean, he doesn't want you to do good deeds. He wants you to be the enemy. He wants to fight. And by doing good, you disarm him. Tertullian said, when Jesus disarmed Peter in the garden, he disarmed all Christians. So we need to think about that. We need to practice it. And people who do it on a day-to-day basis develop tremendously creative ways to defuse violent situations. You're probably going to mention Yoder's book.
Well, I was going to mention that we have a wonderful opportunity in the next couple of weeks. Mary and John Schramm are going to be arriving tomorrow. And they had been, I first met them when they were directors of the Village back in the late 70s and early 80s. And they have written several wonderful books, like Things That Make for Peace, Extravagant Love, I can't remember what the third one was. But they address those same things. And Mary has some very wonderful examples of how to turn enemies into friends. And I hope she does some peace and justice and nonviolent sessions while she's here. Because they are wonderful.
Yeah. One interesting story that I should maybe tell you that I think you need to think about, it's not only about love, but it's about the attainment of the kingdom of the Lamb. And it's from Dostoevsky's Brothers Karamazov. It's a little story entitled The Woman of Little Faith. And this woman had lost her faith, and she was in despair and didn't know if there was a God, or didn't know if God loved her, didn't know if there was eternal life or anything. And she went to this Byzantine holy man and said, would you prove to me that God exists, that God loves me, and that my soul is immortal? And she was just despairing. And he says, I can't tell you that God exists. I can't prove to you that God exists, God loves you, or that your soul is immortal. And she just collapsed. But he says, I can tell you how to, that you can be certain of it. Just every day, on a minute-to-minute basis, do the little deed of Christ-like love, and pretty soon you will realize that God exists, that God loves you, and that your soul is immortal. Just by practicing the, you know, living in the kingdom of the Lamb, the peace plan of God, will then prove to you that all this happens and it works. You know, if you're, you know, the person who is just going through life and making friends of your enemies and that sort of thing, things look up, and if mercy is the standard of judgment at the end of the time, then living the Christ-like life of nonviolent love of friend and enemy may well be the peace plan of God, and it spreads. That influence, you know how violence spreads, nonviolence spreads too.